I'm Robert Siegel, and this is The Connection. It is the domain of poets and dreamers, scientists and madmen. It has inspired a galaxy of creative endeavors and a universe of scientific achievement. It is the night sky. From its chaos has come order, mathematics, religion, time. From its constancy, more questions, the nature of dark matter, the composition of quasars. But there's something different about the night sky. There is less of it to see. Bright lights from big cities wash out the stars' celestial glow. Not even the moon can outshine the Earth's artificial brilliance. There's other competition, too. Hollywood's technicolor renderings of the universe have waylaid our imaginations, dulled our curiosity to know the real thing. And the great indoors, with its televisions and computers and comforts, has left an entire generation satisfied with terra firma, while a vast terra incognita languishes just overhead. Connection listeners, what is your connection to the night sky, and when was the last time you really looked up into it? We are stretching out on a dewy knoll and gazing skyward this hour, and we want you to join us. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call to make the night sky connection. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I'm joined in the studio now by Chet Ramo, author of An Intimate Look at the Night Sky. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Robert.
Chet, your book takes us back to the beginning, when space and time exploded into existence 15 billion years ago, the Big Bang. You chronicle both art and science's quest to know the heavens, and I want to start our hour in the same way that your book starts, with some music. And I want you to instruct our listeners, at least those who are not in their cars right now, as you do in the book, on how to look at the night sky. First, we should cue the night sky. We should summon some night sky for us. We're out in the country right now. It's important to be out in the country.
Away from city lights.
Away from city lights.
For what's about to come.
So we can actually see it.
See it very well, I hope, for this experiment.
And you would have us make this a full sensory experience.
Absolutely.
So, CD player, perhaps? Some headphones?
CD player, personal CD player, cue to Joseph Haydn's The Creation.
Uh-huh. Well, let's cue Joseph Haydn's The Creation. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, we hear, and we're on that knoll in the countryside in the night sky, looking up.
Here's a way to experience the stars as you never have before, and come as close as you can to that first moment of creation. Cue this music. Get under a dark night sky spangled with stars. Be alone, perhaps. Listen to the music with your eyes closed. Haydn visited Herschel, the world's greatest astronomer in the late 18th century, in England in 1782. It was a view through his fantastic new telescope that perhaps inspired the music that we're listening to.
Now we're hearing a chorus, and the music is about to, it's going to become a little bit formless and void in a moment.
And when we hear this fantastic C major chord, which represents the creation, open your eyes. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light.
Haydn's Big Bang, Haydn's The Creation. He had something there. He was onto something.
He was onto something, and it's astonishing how closely the music gives us a sense of the Big Bang as described by contemporary astronomers. When you open your eyes under a fantastically dark night sky to that magnificent chord, I think you're about as close as you're going to get to the Big Bang.
One imagines the most enormous fireworks display ever, with bits of light flying through the sky, shooting outward.
Something like that. It's, of course, an astonishing event described by the astronomers, the universe, in a sense, coming out of nothing, or at least nothing that we can currently know about. And within the first fractions of a second, springing into existence, light becoming matter, matter becoming stars and galaxies in the succeeding millions and billions of years, still today racing outward, expanding toward a fate which, well, what will that fate be? We'll get to that in the last chapter of the book.
Do you remember when you first looked into the night sky?
I do indeed.
Felt that.
In fact, my first memories of the night sky, this was back during the Second World War. I was about 8 or 9 years old, sleeping on the sleeping porch of my grandmother's house in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Sleeping porch was a wonderful thing back in the days before air conditioning in the South. And there I was alone with nothing but a screen separating me from the sounds of the night, the crickets, the whippoorwills, the heat lightning off in the distance, the lightning bugs in the tree, and up above, this astonishing number of stars, especially on those nights when the city's lights were turned off for air raid drills.
And this, of course, is what has changed so much over the years, not only over the years, but over the centuries, that our ancestors looked into the sky and couldn't help but see the sky, the stars on a clear night.
Couldn't help but see the stars, couldn't help but see the Milky Way, couldn't help but see lots of things that so many of us can't see today in cities or in the suburbs. We have been hell-bent on obliterating the stars, the starry night. Great shame, I think, so much of the light that we produce, which of course is necessary in a modern civilization. We run 24 hours a day now, our economy. We need the security. We need the ability to move around at night. But so much of the light that we create goes up in the air and does no good down on Earth. All it serves to do is to obliterate the stars.
More than half a century after you first looked up into the night sky with wonder, does it still pack wonder for you, or have you seen it all?
It still packs wonder. I think I look at the sky almost every night. Even if there aren't any stars, I spend some time in the outside. And when you get to know the sky, when you get intimate with the sky, which is what I'm trying to convey in this book, that sense of real personal intimacy with the night, not just with the stars overhead, but with the whole universe beyond the stars, there's something new and surprising every night.
We're joined now by Kelly Beatty, who is executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. He joins us from Fresno, California. Kelly Beatty, when did you first look into the sky and be captivated by the experience?
Well, Fresno is a rural city in the great San Joaquin Valley. And in my home, as I was growing up, not quite World War II, I was out in the country away from city lights, and you couldn't help but be smacked in the face by the stars as you walked out at night. And so that was a formative event for me. I grew up, as many in my generation, a child of the space age, wanting to be an astronaut, wanting to be an astronomer, and that's where I ended up.
Well, I want to hear from both of you, starting with Chet Ramo, if you would try to, if you would try to convert some person out there who is not a stargazer into becoming one. What's the hook? What do you say they will find if they become habitual skygazers?
Well, what I would hope to convey in this book is that sense of belonging to this fantastic universe we find ourselves living in. Very often when I'm talking about the universe of galaxies to students, they will say to me, it all makes me feel so insignificant, that vast vastness of galaxies, billions, hundreds of billions of galaxies we can see with our telescope. It all makes me feel so insignificant. This seems to me exactly the wrong response. We carry that universe in our heads. We have discovered that universe. Discovering that universe is a human creation. It should make us feel significant. It should make us feel that we are the universe becoming conscious of itself, which is an amazing thing when you think about it. And it's that sense of knowing the night as a representation of the place in this vast universe that we find ourselves, that I think is so important for us to try to recapture.
Kelly Beatty, what's your case for looking into the night sky?
You know, borrowing a line from Chet's book, the sky, the night sky belongs to all of us, paupers and princes, the poorest and the richest. And what we experience at Sky and Telescope is a lot of sky watchers, when they get out under a really dark sky, they imagine themselves not on the Earth any longer, but flying headlong into the universe, and it's rushing by all around them. There's a real three-dimensional quality to it. And I think that the night sky is the last great frontier for inspiration and imagination. We've conquered so much else here on the Earth that when you get outside and get dark, your mind is free to imagine what might be and what's out there, and I think that's a heady experience in and of itself.
Now, I want Chet Remo, you to explain something to me here, as very much a novice here, and also as someone who grew up in New York City. I really didn't see that much of the night sky growing up. It's a lot of smoke. You're sitting with me in Boston, Massachusetts right now. Kelly is in Fresno, California. If you both go out tonight and look at the sky, and you have many prints and pictures of what we would see in the night sky at various seasons of the year, how similar is what we will see, or should we be looking in different places for the same stars?
Well, what Kelly and I would see would be pretty much the same. What we see depends on, to a large extent, on our latitude on Earth, that is, how far north and south we are, but not on east and west. One has a star map for Boston, it's going to work pretty good for San Francisco, too.
But Mexico City?
Mexico City, we're pushing it. We're pushing it then. Southern Hemisphere would be a very different sky indeed. You'd see different stars. You'd see Orion standing on his head.
That's why, for example, people in the Northern Hemisphere, navigators, had the benefit of a pole star that they would sail by.
And people in the south did not. The sky around the southern celestial pole doesn't have that same fairly bright star that we're lucky enough to have here in the north, at least for the time being. That will pass. Our Earth's axis has a 26,000-year wobble to it, and that wobble will eventually take us away from the North Star.
Yes, that someday Polaris will not be the North Star.
Someday Polaris will not be the North Star. We'll not have a North Star. The day will come when Vega, the bright summer star, will be fairly close to the pole.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Kelly Beatty, it's my impression, is very much the less than amateur here, that all this serious stuff with telescopes is now done on top of a mountain in Hawaii, and or with the Hubble Space Telescope, or with the tools that are way beyond the reach of the layman. What's left to us who don't have a spare couple of billion to make an electron or to make a space telescope for ourselves?
The mantra we preach is that astronomy doesn't have to be hard. You don't need a telescope. You don't even need binoculars to learn something of the sky and appreciate what it has in store for us. These days, even well-educated people have less knowledge of the sky than several generations ago, the simplest farmer, the simplest schoolgirl, because they grew up under these stars and knew them and knew what they had to say. For example, in the winter, when the great constellation Orion would rise up over the east, you knew that winter was coming. In the spring, when the summer triangle and Scorpius arched its head over the eastern horizon, you knew that warmer weather was coming. People don't know these things anymore, but back in those days, everyone did. And there's no reason why people these days can't be that way now.
Our guests are Kelly Beatty and Chet Remo. Our number 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the stars on The Connection from NPR.
When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come.
From Boston University, this is W.
It's The Connection. I'm Robert Siegel. Our guests are Kelly Beatty, executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, and Chet Remo, author of An Intimate Look at the Night Sky. Chet Remo, people in my line of work very often call up people in your line of work when a comet is coming by, when there's an eclipse, or when there's an item in the paper today concerning brown dwarfs, for example. these are the news stories. These are the times when astronomy makes it into the news pages. What about all the other days? I mean, is there enough there to sustain one's interest on just an ordinary time when... Or is there something spectacular happening every night in the sky that's different?
Well, there's nothing spectacular happening every night in the sky, but there's something happening virtually every night in the sky. First of all, there's just the sheer pleasure of recognition of, as Kelly suggested a minute ago, of seeing Orion as you're driving home late in a fall night and knowing that winter's about to come. That sense, that pleasure that comes from being familiar with something. But It's not just the familiarity. It's also the variation from the familiarity, the appearance of the comet, the summer Mars riding with red Antares and Scorpio low in the south. Those variations from the familiar, which make every night at least potentially unusual. If you spend enough time under the night sky and know what you're looking at, and there's lots of ways to do that. One is to buy a good star book, to use the maps and an intimate look at the night sky, or to subscribe to Sky and Telescope magazine, which tells you what to look for every month. You're going to find something to see every night.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255, and we start with Bill, who's on the line.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice topic. The question you started out with on your show was, what exactly did the night sky evoke in you, or invoke in the listeners? Mm-hmm. And the thought that occurred to me was the very first thing, when I was brought up in New York, in Brooklyn, and I'd be looking up at the night sky as we're walking along the pavement, you know, in between the skyscrapers or the tenement buildings or whatever. But then the second experience that was so vivid in my mind was when we came up to Massachusetts on vacations in cottages we were staying. And in the middle of the night, you'd wake up and you'd go outside, and if there was a full moon, the woods were all lit up, and you had this incredible sky, but at the same time, you could see everything. You could probably read a newspaper on certain bright nights. And then the third thought that occurred to me was my first winter country experience, where you'd be ice skating at night, and in the middle of the night, like 11, 12, even 1 in the morning, we'd be ice skating, and you'd have this incredible deep blue sky with these little glass-cut diamonds all over the sky, the stillness and everything. And I guess the final thought that occurs to me is how infrequent those experiences are now. I mean, I go to the Berkshires, and you get to certain areas where you can look up, and you don't get the light pollution that you get around eastern Massachusetts. But I think your commentator there touched on something. We're totally out of touch with our natural surroundings, not just simply the sky. I mean, you got a whole generation out there that thinks that golf courses are the most beautiful pieces of real estate they've ever seen in their lives. You know, lawns, for example, they consider to be a natural condition as opposed to, let's say, a field of weeds.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to the skies, I mean, the city skyline, I mean, I've had people tell me that Las Vegas was the most beautiful lit-up experience they'd ever experienced, and totally oblivious of night skies.
Well, Bill, thank you very much for calling. And I want to ask Chet Ramos, let me ask you about something that Bill said about the moon being bright. If we go out on a night when the moon is full, let's say, help or a hindrance to seeing the stars?
Well, it's a help to seeing the moon, but a hindrance to seeing the deep sky. You're going to see them. You still see the major constellations, and you'll still recognize familiar landmarks. But that experience of seeing the sky absolutely spangled with stars that you might get in a really dark place, the moon would be a hindrance to that. But that's part of the always changing show. Any sky watcher loves the constantly changing phases of the moon, the elevation of the sun in the sky as the seasons change. All of these are part of that experience that gives you a familiarity with the night sky and a sense of belonging to the universe. And the more you know about what you're looking at, the deeper that sense of belonging will be. Not just what's out there, but how we know it's out there.
Molly is calling from Canton, New York. Molly, you're on the line.
I couldn't resist calling. It's a great topic. Just a couple of comments and a question. In northern New York, we still have incredible night skies, and we have the northern lights, and we had the comet. And so there are lots of opportunities for people, and myself as a child, and then also my children, what I think is interesting about it is it's the interest, the combination of science and spirit. That it's, on one hand, a very scientific thing to look at, but it's also incredibly spiritual, that it's the infiniteness of it and the wondrousness of it. And for children, like your other caller said, who oftentimes think that Disney and light shows are the thing, the sky is an every night occasion for them to realize what's truly wondrous.
It also must be a remarkable connection for a child with with history to get a sense of, at one time, the very idea of seeing constellations, of making connections among different stars and imagining that they are something out there, is a rare moment to really appreciate what our ancestors did and how they lived.
But I do have a question.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between an eclipse and just the phases of the moon?
An eclipse and the phases of the moon. Kelly, do you want to take that one?
Sure.
I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
Let's start with the eclipse. That's actually the easier part. When the moon passes through the Earth's shadow, which doesn't happen very often, it goes black. And that is an eclipse of the moon. Now, as it turns out, the moon can also come between the Earth and the sun, casting its shadow on the Earth. And in just a couple of weeks, that will happen over Africa and the Eastern Hemisphere, and that's an eclipse of the sun. In fact, thousands of people are converging on Africa or planning to see that. Now, when the moon goes dark in a lunar eclipse, it takes a very stately progression through the Earth's shadow over a course of a couple of hours, goes in and comes out. In contrast, you asked about the phases of the moon. As the Earth turns around the Earth in its orbit, we sometimes see
Turns around the sun in its orbit, yes.
No. The moon circles
The moon turns around the Earth, yes, excuse me.
That's right. The moon circles the Earth about once every month, which is where the word came from, month, moon. And in that progression, we sometimes see the moon's face totally illuminated with sunlight, and that's a full moon. Sometimes we see it from the side, and that's a quarter moon. Sometimes we don't see it at all because it's in the direction of the sun, and that's a new moon. So that's a month-long progression, and those phases happen every month, to coin a phrase, just like clockwork.
There's an anachronism for you. Yes, Chet Ramo.
Let me pick up on something else Molly said. Teaching her children the stars, that's, of course, something that in the past was passed down from generation to generation, some star lore. I was fortunate enough to learn a lot of this lore from my father, who in 1946 received a star book for Christmas, which I still own. I think it's long out of print, A Primer for Stargazers by Henry Neely. But as he learned the stories of the sky, as he learned the stars and the constellations and all those stories, he taught them to me out on the badminton court behind our house in Chattanooga. No child ever had a more vivid and more wonderful storybook than I had in the sky over that badminton court.
And let me jump in here. Obviously, maybe a lot of parents are a little intimidated by the prospect of trying to pass on star lore to their children. But those books are easily available, and you can both learn together. I really compel all of the listeners this summer to find some dark night location. Take a couple of lounge chairs later in the summer, July or so, when the Milky Way is arching overhead. Most of you have never seen a truly dark sky and have never appreciated its power to inspire you and just have you open-mouthed in awe. It's easy to do, and most of you haven't done it, and you really should.
Our number, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Jack is on the line.
Hi, good afternoon, or good morning to you folks. Just your last comment really struck me, because that's what I was going to comment on. I'm one of the fortunate people. I used to sail for a living, and used to use the stars to navigate around the world. So every night, every evening, every morning, we had to use stars for navigation. And it's still used today, but not as much as it used to be, so we're losing that also. But there, too, I've been one of the fortunate people to have been on a completely black, cloudless night and in the middle of the ocean, no light, no illumination from anything, and to look around and be totally awestruck at just how many stars there are out there. And one time I even got to watch a planet rise as you would watch a sunrise or a moonrise. I got to watch a planet rise out of the ocean into the sky. And just to see these things, it's absolutely phenomenal. And yeah, if people can, go to a dark night and just look, they'll be totally amazed at what's out there. I have tried to do that with my family, and whenever we do get a good dark night in this area of Massachusetts, we will do that. But I always wind up telling them, we can't see everything because there's still the loom from Boston. Even though I'm 50 miles away, there's still the loom from it in the sky.
Hmm.
But, yeah, it is. It's incredible. If people get out there, even if they don't know the stories, and over the years I've picked up a little bit of the law of the Orion, the hunter, chasing the bull, who is chasing the Pleiades, the seven maidens in the sky, and there's all neat stories about it. But even if you don't, just to look up in amazement and start recognizing that, well, when I was a kid, I didn't know Orion, but I used to look at it and say, that's a yield sign up in the sky. It looks like a yield sign that you'd see on the street corner. Stuff like that. You don't even need to know the law. Just look and say, I recognize that. There's a triangle and a square and a diamond or a fork. But there's things in the sky, just like the ancients would look up and come up with, that's a bull, that's a dog. And to this day, I'm still trying to figure out what they were drinking when they were looking at those stars.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jack.
Thank you.
Jack is hardly the only person, Chet Ramo, to have looked at the sky and felt inspired in addition to feeling navigated. You've actually collected a lot of verse that was inspired by stargazers in your book.
I try to make this sky experience a kind of total sensory experience. That the book contains references to music, to poetry, to history, to art. All of that is part of our history, part of our experience of the sky, and enriches any night that we might have. One story I tell, it took place not too long ago when I was down on the island of Exuma with a group of young students, a pitch dark night in a pitch dark place, watching the stars come up in the east because of the rotation of the earth, seeing the Milky Way arching overhead, our galaxy, seeing what's called the zodiacal light, a faint band of light rising up vertically from the western horizon, which represents dust in the plane of the solar system. And there we were, trying to feel those three great rotations on the Earth, around the Sun, and around the great Milky Way galaxy. It was a very, almost vertigo experience.
Our number, 1-800-423-8255. Rodney is on the line.
Yeah, hi there.
Hi.
This all brought to mind this poem by W.H. Auden, which I thought would be nice to bring up. It's four short stanzas. So, looking up at the stars, I know quite well that for all they care, I can go to hell. But on earth, indifference is the least we have to dread from man or beast. How should we like it were the stars to burn with a passion for us we could not return? If equal affection cannot be, let the more loving one be me. Admirer as I think I am of stars that do not give a damn, I cannot, now I see them, say I missed one terribly all day. Were all stars to disappear or die, I should learn to look at an empty sky and feel its total dark sublime, though this might take me a little time.
Okay. Thank you. What is the title of the poem, by the way?
It's called The More Loving One.
The More Loving One. That's a lovely little poem. Could you learn, Chet Ramo, to love a totally dark sky, or would that take all the thrill out of it?
I think I could, yes. It's like asking, could I learn to love a totally overcast sky? That would be a little different, I think. The Earth might well have been completely overcast, like our sister planet Venus. And just think of how different history would have been. Science, mathematics, religion, all had their origin in our experience of this night sky, that all that it inspires, the beauty that it inspires. So it's interesting to ask what life might have been like and what history would have been like, what human culture would have been like without those stars in the sky. But I don't sit around pining for the starry night. If it's a little hole in the clouds, I'm happy to get out there and look through it.
Kelly Beattie, a question that relates to what our caller Jack earlier said about seeing a planet rise, I guess while he was at sea. How common is it for one to look at the sky and be able to see a planet rise or set?
Right now is a terrific time to see the planet Mars, which is coming its closest to Earth in its orbit for the first time in 13 years. You need to go out. Anyone can see this about 10:30 at night and look to the southeast, and you'll see this blazing yellowish-red beacon rising out of the murk, and that is the planet Mars. It's red. It's named after the god of war. The ancients saw it as red. And this is a fantastic time to be seeing Mars. If you have a small telescope pointed at Mars, and you might well catch a glimpse of the brilliant icy white polar caps which that planet has. So these planets do come and go. If you stay up and are up before dawn, you'll see something screaming in the east. It is not a UFO. It is the planet Venus, often thought of as the evening star, but it can be seen in the morning as well. So these planets do come and go. They have their own cycles. The ancients recognized that they had cycles. The planets is a word from Greek, meaning the wanderers, and that's something we should be out looking out for.
If I could manage to see Mars this evening, how long would its flight across the sky take, or where would I pick it up and where would it end when I last saw it?
As the world turns, Robert, it's rising in the east around 10 o'clock, and it will stay up virtually all night, setting before dawn in the west, as all the stars do. This is just one of many cycles. Mars is, as I said, coming its closest to Earth, so it's particularly bright right now. Just to the right of Mars in the sky is another bright star called Antares, which is also from the Greek called rival of Mars, and it is also reddish. One of the things I want to point out is if you don't have a telescope and don't know what to do under that dark night sky, look for color, faint hints of color in the various stars. It's important because redder stars are cooler. Bluer stars are hotter, and that in and of itself is something to take away.
And the redness of Mars is something different altogether, I assume.
Right. Imagine yourself in the great southwest of the United States. You look across the desert, and you see these tinges of red from the iron that has rusted away in the rocks. Exactly the same thing has happened on Mars. And it's a vicarious experience, you know. Even given Steven Spielberg and NASA's space probes, you can imagine yourself, as you gaze at that red beacon in the night sky, you can imagine yourself standing on the surface of Mars.
The night sky is our subject on The Connection from NPR.
I saw it written and I saw it say, Bingo Moon is on his way. None of you stand so tall. Bingo Moon, and I get you.
From Boston University, this is W.
It's The Connection. I'm Robert Siegel. My guests, Chet Ramo, author of An Intimate Look at the Night Sky, and Kelly Beatty, executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. Our number, 1-800-423-8255. And Sharon is on the line.
Hi. excuse me. I have three quick comments.
Okay.
One is, when I was little, I loved the stars so much that I used to have an oatmeal box with holes poked in it and a flashlight. If I couldn't go out and see stars, I'd sit in the closet and rotate the oatmeal box around the flashlight, and it was my little planetarium. And then when I grew up and moved on to bigger things, I was pointing out of mine the Northern Cross and the Summer Triangle, and I was kind of saying, well, there's this star and that star, and what's that? And it turned out this was in the mid to late nova.
Oh, Sherry, you're cutting in and out a little bit. So tell us again, what was it that you saw?
It turned out to be, I don't know how to turn this stupid call waiting off. I just got it. But it turned out to be a nova that had just, you know, sort of blown up and began to be visible. It was really exciting. So it does pay to, you know, keep an eye on the sky.
That's terrific.
And then my third comment is for people to realize that for about $150, you can buy a telescope that will allow you to see the four moons, four of Jupiter's moons, and the rings of Saturn. If you can find some dark space.
Yeah, it might be easier to find the telescope than to find the dark space.
It probably is, but if you can do it, it's really worth it.
Okay, Sharon, thanks a lot for calling.
Thank
you. And on to Tom, who is calling from, is it Roslindale, Massachusetts?
Roslindale.
Well, you're on the air.
Hi. I owe my awareness of the sky to Jack Borden, probably 20 years or so back when he was at WBZ. He really promoted awareness of the sky. Are you there?
Yes, we're here. Chet Ramo, you remember Jack Borden?
I do remember Jack Borden. He's done probably as much as anybody around here for giving us a consciousness of the sky, and not just the night sky, but even the daytime sky.
Well, I have a story, and then I'd like to ask Professor Ramo a quick question. We camp every summer up in Vermont at Groton State Forest, and every year, as soon as my daughter's asleep, my wife and I will take the binoculars and go off to this big open field lay on our backs and watch for shooting stars. And it took me years and years before this city kid found out that I was laying out in the leaching field of the septic system, the one open space in the woods. So, but we love it up there, and it's the one chance we have to really be able to see a clear night sky. But, Professor Ramo, I'm going to spend the weekend at Stonehill. I'm a volunteer at the Irish Festival. That's not far enough out, really, to see clear night sky, is it?
Well, you're better off there than you are in the city, but fortunately, that the lights are gradually creeping out and obliterating our stars in the suburbs as well. But
is there any chance we'll see you there?
You might see me there at the festival. Yeah. Let me respond quickly to something Sharon said about looking up one night and seeing a nova in the sky.
Yes, yes.
I suspect she's talking about the nova that appeared in the constellation Cygnus in August of 1975. What a thing that was, to look up at the sky to a familiar constellation, the Great Swan, and see a new and fairly bright star for a few days. In a constellation where previously there had been no star. That's the kind of wonderful surprise that can occur occasionally in the night sky. But if you're not already familiar with what you're looking at, that new star is not going to make a bit of difference.
Now, I think that Sharon was saying, as her call waiting interrupted her for a moment, that it was in the mid-70s. And that is a rare enough event that you would know that probably is what she saw.
I would think so, yeah. A bright nova is a fairly rare event.
Kelly Beatty?
Nova Cygni. And what that was is, imagine the sun in a cathartic eruption shedding its entire outer layer out into space in a violent – the energy is incomprehensible, causing this star that was otherwise invisible to us, to our unaided eye, to suddenly blaze forth in glory. So this is a part of the imagination. Sharon, you were seeing a star in one of its final death throes. And there's the imagination again that it just hits you right in the face and you can't avoid it.
And when Tom goes out with his wife in the summer from camping to look in the sky for shooting stars, first, should he reasonably expect the odds are he will see one? And second, what exactly is he seeing?
Well, an interesting point. If you go out in the evening sky right now and look up high in the southwest, you'll see a bright star at the end of a backward question mark, and that is the constellation of Leo the Lion. Every November, there is a meteor shower called the Leonids, which appear to come from that constellation. By November, Leo will be in the morning sky, not to confuse things. But this coming November, the Leonids are going to be at their very best. We anticipate a meteor storm, as astronomers call them, where maybe thousands of meteors per hour could be seen from a dark location. That'll be November 18th. I want you to all go mark that on your calendars.
And we should be able to see that with the naked eye?
No question. No question. A couple of years ago, I was on a NASA plane over Europe watching this meteor storm, and it was like the Earth was under attack. It was just that impressive.
Okay. Well, thanks to Tom for calling, and on to Matthew, who's on the line. Matthew?
Good morning, folks. Just a very inspirational topic, and it kind of had me sitting back thinking about shooting stars and the difference between a sky where there's light pollution and when there isn't. And I just felt I wanted to share this story. I grew up near Binghamton, New York, which doesn't have too much light pollution, especially when you drive away from the city, and I attended college there. And many of the students at SUNY Binghamton were from New York City, and they literally had never seen a shooting star.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would borrow my mom's car, and we would truck across the border into Pennsylvania, which was away from any light, and just look up at the sky. The thing that was most amazing to me was their reaction, not of the shooting star, which we almost always saw if we looked long enough, but just that sound of the inhaled breath when they would get out of the car and see that sky for the first time. They had never seen it before. They had no clue, and it just was... And I heard that sound one more time recently when I took my son, who has Down syndrome, by the way, and doesn't talk very much, to a similar place. And we got out of the car, and he looked, and he just went, sky. And that was the first time he'd ever said that word.
Chad?
The Leonids, which Kelly mentioned in November, it may or may not be as spectacular as he suggests, but they're certainly worth looking for. And it's the kind of not that he's wrong, but they're very difficult to predict exactly what you're going to see. The year 1999, I was on the roof of our observatory science building down in, at Stonehill College with a group of students enthusiastically watching the Leonides. And the people on the rest of the campus told me later that every now and then they would hear this great sound go up from the roof of the science building. Oh, ah, as Matthew was suggesting
very,
just a minute ago.
Very closely related to Matthew's sound,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And so all night long, that's what the rest of the campus heard was, oh, ah, as another brilliant meteorite would shoot across the sky. But in fact, it was the previous year, 1998, I was up on the deck with two students. In fact, the two students to whom this book is dedicated. And unfortunately, it was a cloudy night. There was some possible hope that the sky was going to clear before dawn. So we laid out all night in a drenching mist. And in some ways, Robert, that night with those two young men waiting for the Leonides that never came was as pleasant an experience as it was the next year when they were shooting all over the sky.
Even if you never got that or whatever the sound is that Matthew in that wonderful story recounted. Matthew, thank you very much for calling, by the way. And we're going to turn now to Dan, who's on the line from Buffalo, New York.
Hi. Item that I don't think people have mentioned is the fact that when we're looking up at the sky, we're actually seeing far, far into the past, that we're really seeing events that occurred thousands and millions of years ago. So there's a special wonder to that, or especially if you build a small telescope yourself that you've, out of this piece of glass that you've been rubbing for hours and hours, you've created a time machine to really see that far into the past and into the history of the universe. And the second point is that if only our eyes were a little more sensitive to light, instead of those white spots or those spots with hints of color, we'd see as if someone threw a treasure chest of emeralds and garnets and rubies against this black velvet in the sky. It'd be a wondrous thing. I just wish my eyes were a little more sensitive to light. But those are my two main points.
Well, thank you very much.
You're
for
welcome.
That, Dan. Ched Ramo. We look into the past, and we are seeing things when we see light arriving from space that happened billions of years ago.
Well, what you're looking at depends on how far away it is. You're looking at the nearest star, even. You're looking 4 years into the past. Mm-hmm. If you're looking at that little smudge of light that you might see from a dark place in the summer, which we call the central part of the Andromeda Galaxy, you're looking 2 million years into the past, back to the very beginning of humanity here on this planet. And there's a sense in which even the darkness of the night sky is a way of looking all the way back to the very beginning of the universe itself. I tell that story early in An Intimate Look at the Night Sky, of how the darkness of the night itself is telling us something about the universe's history.
The way that we see constellations depends on the perspective of being on Earth. I assume that we happen to see a number of stars that form a figure of a hunter, let's say, Orion, from the Northern Hemisphere, because we're looking at them that way. If we were somehow to get to a very different corner of space, those stars are not necessarily aligned. They're not in the same plane forming that image.
Like the constellations we're seeing in two dimensions. The sky, of course, is a three-dimensional thing, and those stars would look very different from a different place. If one was on Alpha Centauri looking this way, one would see a star in the constellation Cassiopeia, which would just happen to be our sun, our star. So what you see very much depends on where you are in the universe.
And your time, because in 100,000 years, even the Big Dipper is not going to look like a Dipper anymore. Imagine the stars as swarming all around us like a beehive in ultra slow motion, and you get a sense of how we're just with the patterns that we see in the sky are a consequence of the here and now.
Last call from Skip, who's calling from his car in New Hampshire. Skip, you're on the line.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call, everyone. Very interesting subject. I just had a comment on being fortunate enough to travel to the Southwest quite a bit, and a little town above Taos called Cuesta, in a cabin almost 10,000 feet above sea level, where my wife and I always comment that not only can you see so many more stars, and it feels like you can almost touch the Milky Way, but I swear it seems like you can hear them as well, and that's really my only comment, and it's just incredibly beautiful and spiritual.
Well, Chet Ramo, you had us go and lie down in the grass out in the country at the beginning and listen to Haydn. Would we have been wiser to go climb a mountain than look up at the sky?
For high elevation, of course, is going to help you in terms of seeing a dark night sky. But one doesn't have to go to a high elevation. Just get away from the city. Get in the car and drive somewhere where you're away from city lights, and you're going to have a spectacular experience. People are always telling me, wow, I couldn't believe it, when they find themselves in a really dark night place for the first time. There are so many stars that, in fact, sometimes it's hard to recognize the constellations you're familiar with. And it's certainly an experience which was a part of our ancestors' experience of the world. It's out of that experience that so much of our history, our science, our religion, our mathematics comes. And it'd be a great shame if we lose it by putting so much unnecessary light into the night sky.
And Kelly Beatty, do you ever wonder if somewhere out there on some planet circling one of those specks, there's somebody on some sleeping porch looking out and seeing us?
Actually, I tend to think that we're pretty rare in the grand scheme of things. And one thing I want to mention, sorry, Robert, before we close, otherwise I'd be remiss. We've been talking about getting away from these city lights as if it's a hopeless situation. There is an organization called the International Dark Sky Association, darksky.org, that has as its goal to reduce the amount of light pollution. We've mentioned that word a couple of times. And people can do this on the individual level. If you have a light in your backyard that shines from dusk to dawn, think about whether you really need that for your security.
Well, thanks so much, Kelly Beatty, who is executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, by the way. He joined us from a studio in Fresno, California. And also to Chet Ramo, who's here in the studio in Boston. Chet is the author of An Intimate Look at the Night Sky. We had help today from Glenn Alexander, from Kim Bachari, from Darun Manoogian, Doug Shugarts, and our intern, Tom Gilmore. Thanks also to Jorge Ramirez in Fresno. The Connection is produced by Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Michael Cavanaugh, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Gavin Moses, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Ben Walker. Our senior producer and our North Star is Graham Smith. To continue the Night Sky Connection, you can go to our website, theconnection.org. I'm Robert Siegel. I've had a great week, and this is The Connection.
This is WBUR.